After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hi, it's Raghu. I am back, and I'm back with a brand new, going to be a long-term friend, I can tell, Michael Taft. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, I feel welcome, Raghu. Thanks for having me on.
So Michael has done some fantastic work around mindfulness, but I would say the real mindfulness. Because mindfulness is bandied about today by everyone's a mindfulness expert today, but it's about true spirituality, not about getting better at being a stockbroker. So Michael have a lot to say about that, and so deconstructing yourself is the site, right? Is what
yeah.
you.
Yeah, Deconstructing Yourself is my main blog site that's been around since something like 2011.
And not just a blog, but you're doing podcasts as well. We should let people know that they can check in with you with some wonderful guests that I saw.
Starting about a year ago, I just was having all these really deep, wonderful, and just, I don't know, to me, very fascinating conversations with various teachers on the phone. And at a certain point, I think it was I was talking with Kenneth Folk, the mindfulness, the hardcore Dharma mindfulness instructor. And we were like, why aren't we recording this? We should record this. It's a cool conversation. So we recorded about three of them. And that became the beginning of the Deconstructing Yourself podcast. So that's been really, really fun.
I love the name. I think it's fabulous. Can you talk about, everything we do at Be Here Now Network and certainly on Mind Rolling is about how can we share the most practical down-to-earth information, you don't have to be a Buddhist or a Hindu or anything-ish, with people to get life in balance. That's our theme here is life in balance. So yeah, let's start. Let's do a deconstruct here. Let's talk about that.
Let's get our minds rolling, Raghu.
Yeah.
So, you know, I am a student of several different teachers, but one of my main teachers is Shinzen Young, who you might know of.
Yes.
You know, AKA Steve Young, who is a very creative mindfulness teacher and, you know, has brought together many different practices from many different traditions into a very detailed and kind of complex meditation structure that covers practically every possible meditation base. He's just a fascinating guy. I love Shinzen, and I'm really grateful to him for a lot of his teachings. And one of the things that he teaches is a technique he calls focus in, where you're taking not just the body sensations that we usually do in mindfulness, but the more expanded, like full version of the Satipatthana Sutta mindfulness, where it's regular body sensations and body sensations of emotion, and then the mental thoughts, mental talk, and mental images. And you're tracking all that separately with like this really detailed mindfulness. So you're really paying attention to internal experience in a kind of analytical way. And the more we did that, year after year after year, just meditating on sort of the internal experience in that way, I realized, you know, what I was watching happen was just the momentary arising and passing of the ego, the arising and passing of another ego, the arising and passing of another ego, moment by moment. And I'm like, wow, this whole practice is just about deconstructing yourself. And that just, that the phrase just kind of went up in my mind. And I'm like, so that's what this is. It's deconstructing yourself. And I got more and more excited about the idea. And it, I just thought it made kind of a intriguing and weird title for a blog. A long time ago, and I've just stuck with it ever since.
Okay, so tell us, what was the impulse or the trigger that led you to even think you would want to pursue any part of this journey of finding of deconstruction? What are the things? I mean, you know, I've talked a lot about it in the early podcasts about my own triggers, which were obviously psychedelics was a major trigger, and so was music.
Why do you say obviously?
Well, my...
I'm kidding.
You know what? I'm still, you know, so in my role as director of the Love, Serve, Remember Foundation, Ram Dass and Neem Karoli Baba, excuse me, in that role, I get mail. And I siphon it off to wherever it needs to go, just to make sure I'm on top of it, because Ram Dass himself can't be handling that kind of thing at this point. He's not interested. He's interested for to get, you know, certain letters that are people really reaching out to him, and I keep him informed. But as a result...
Happy birthday to Ram Dass.
Oh, yes, Ram Dass's birthday today. Yeah, that's auspicious. We're doing this, Michael, on this day. I just... what I'm trying to say is that so many people are still writing in around, and they're in their early 20s or something, you know, next generation. Okay, I took a psychedelic and I found this book, Be Here Now, and suddenly my life has changed, and I'm like, can you help out, flesh this out for me? I can't tell you how much. So wow. That phenomenon of the combo of psychedelics and Be Here Now and still and college I found it, a friend of mine, the table in college, you know, that is still going on. It's extraordinary to me. So yes, yeah. And certainly back then that was a major trigger for many of us, and not you. I know
not
that
me.
You didn't do anything like that because you're a Buddhist. Buddhists don't do that.
But I'm just as much of a Hindu and just as much of a not either of those. So,
Okay. So tell us, what were the triggers though to just realize there's a path to freedom?
You know, the early trigger is like most people's, just total pain and suffering. Which, you know,
it's helpful. Yeah.
Which mainly took the form of extreme anxiety. You know, by the time I was in high school. It's just getting those kind of panic attacks where you can't even move, you know, you're just, it's really, really unpleasant. And this is like 1970s Michigan. There just wasn't any, you know, there wasn't much available in terms of help. And, but I had heard about this thing, meditation. And, you know, I remember I read books like John Lilly's book about, you know, like the brain and flotation tanks and stuff. So I just had some ideas about stuff you could do. So I started doing the kind of like a yoga nidra type practice where you just do a progressive relaxation over and over and over. And what do you know, it's kind of relieved my anxiety. So I was hooked. Right. And I also read quite a bit. Once I went to college, I read quite a bit of Robert Anton Wilson, those types of books, and lots of Ram Dass, and got heavily into the psychedelics for sure.
Yeah.
And the rest, you know, is just pursuing that path of meditation.
Interestingly enough, of course, after getting a little bit up to date with you, and the things that you've done and your interests, certainly Am I assuming, have you been to India yourself?
Yeah, actually. quite a bit.
So like me, just love India.
Not as much as you, but a lot. You know? Yeah. I love it. My Hindu teacher was Dhyan Yogi Sri Madhusudan Dasji, so very strong Hanuman Ram lineage.
Oh.
And so
where was he?
He was in the heaven on earth of Ahmedabad. So, city of dust. So spent a lot of time in Gujarat, but also, you know, tons of pilgrimage around the Himalayas.
And what was that tradition? What was his...
You know, he is a very unusual character. He was, I think he started out as a Ramanand monk and then kind of had some very large awakenings on his own and kind of went off and became a wandering sadhu for many, many, many decades. And then eventually landed in rural Gujarat in a little village outside of Rajkot called, now I'm just going to blank on the name, Bandwar. I've been there a bunch of times. It's called Bandwar. It's way out. Beautiful thing, beautiful place. And so he was just the head of they begged him to be the head of the temple there. And he's like, look, I don't do that. I'm a sadhu. But eventually he was like, okay, they had a little Hanuman temple and he became big in the 70s in Bombay and then actually came to the U.S. for about 4 years in the early 70s.
Wow.
And the tradition is kind of unusual. It's a very strong Ram Hanuman devotional, but together with a lot of like Kundalini Tantra stuff, very strong, heavy duty Shaktipat Kundalini stuff.
Wow. That is an interesting combo.
Right. Very, very rare.
Yeah. You're going to, we'll have to get from you a way that people can link up to just find out more about him. And
That tradition is called Dhyan Yoga Centers.
Uh-huh.
And so that particular group is DYC.org, Dhyan Yoga Centers. So DYC.org. Okay. His main heir is Anandima, Sri Anandima. She lives in Antioch here. And I've known her for decades. So,
so there's some connectivity with this tradition to this day, or?
Oh, absolutely. I've had nothing but a good experience. I'm not super active with the practices at this point, but that was certainly my main practice for a long, long time. Mm. And even the house I'm in here, which is my friend's house, if I took the computer around and showed you, it's all like Ram and Hanuman images and devotional stuff.
Right up our alley then.
Yeah, there we go.
Sorry, I just was in the center of all of that in the Himalayas. And
lucky you, yeah.
Yeah, really. It's interesting because we're talking about traditions and I think before we got on I said, well, let's talk about the intersection of non-duality, which is a very strong intent that you have for sure of sharing that with people.
Yeah.
So non-duality, where's the intersection of non-duality and bhakti yoga, which is the tradition that I come from. But the thing with Neem Karoli Baba was we all, and this has been said many times before, but he didn't tell us to do anything. He didn't teach. But we all ended up at the Vipassana course with Sharon and Joseph and Jack. So
at a Goenka center?
Yeah, in Bodh Gaya.
Yeah.
And back in that day. And so there is an intersection for us of that tradition informing the bhakti tradition that we are very much a part of. And so that's why when I saw that, I didn't know about Dhyan Yogi, but I saw that you had experience with Hinduism in that way, and I wondered what that intersection was still for you, because I guess what I'm getting at, beating around the bush, Mike.
What are you trying to get at, Raghu? Just spit it out.
that sometimes the non-dual thing I've seen, you know, many people, I feel like there's a real trap there because of the exquisite understanding that people can have through the non-dual lens. I have something from you called Non-Dual Fundamentalism and Limitless Awakening, in which you are, it's basically a very cautionary thing about just what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
But non-dual awareness is just so lovely. The most beautiful part of the non-dual experience is how it encompasses all things. As the name itself suggests, there are not two things anywhere, but simply one vast, spacious, capital yes of the universe. Non-duality is the awareness that says yes to all things, says yes even to no, even to no dash thing. It is a direct experience of the already perfect and pureness of the entire universe, because there are not two. It has no opposite, it bears no contradiction, and it has no enemies or problems. As beautiful and powerful as non-dual experience is, like all spiritual awakenings, it has some unskillful expressions that can lead to unnecessary difficulties in regular old duality, like your life. It can even end up derailing your further awakening, which is, you know, what a nice writing, nice little piece of writing, gets right to the point. What is just really what I've had this dialogue before, and just that trap is a gigantic trap in my mind, when the practices that are in, you know, from Vipassana forward, and mindfulness and awareness, and Ram Dass calls witness, they are tremendous aids in our day-to-day processing of our lives. And at the same time, without that, the heart, I think it's a difficult thing. So that's where I was beating around the bush.
it's really interesting, Raghu. You know, I'm not dedicated to criticizing any particular practice. You know, that's not what I'm about. I love all the expressions, you know, everything bhakti and mindfulness and various tantric practices and non-dualism or non-dual practices and a lot of other stuff. I think it's all wonderful. And because I've worked with so much of it for so long, in just a really practical way, you kind of see each different practice has its own thing it's really good at, right? And each individual kind of style of practice also has its thing that you, where it's really typically going off the rails. You know, you just notice that, geez, a lot of people in that kind of tradition are kind of missing it in this one way, and in this other tradition, they've got that covered, but they're missing it in another way. So I just want to start out there and say, you know, yes, these are all wonderful traditions that I love and respect. I think with non-dualism, it, you know, simply put, it's just the not only perfection of awareness, but the perfection, it can be the perfection of spiritual bypassing, right? It can just be so easily misused to decide that there's nothing we need to do anywhere because there's no problems, everything's already perfect. Therefore, I don't have to help my neighbor, and I don't even have to, you know, fix my own crappy personality or whatever. It's all already perfect.
Be kind,
right? It's so true. And that kind of spiritual bypassing, of course, arises in all traditions, not just non-dualism, but for whatever reason, because of the way non-dual practices work, it just really lends itself to that. So you do see a lot of what I would consider to be kind of checked out, dissociative, spiritually bypassing sort of individuals who are, you know, in that tradition. But again,
how about an example of a spiritual bypass? Give us an example of this.
Oh, it's easy. You know, I don't need, you know, I've had people tell me this a lot, like, hey, the Trump presidency, which is a catastrophe to the entire world, to all animals, to all beings. I mean, it's a catastrophe, right? But I know I've heard from many people who say something like, hey, I just don't get involved in that. I don't think about it. It's not important. Everything's already perfect and pure. And so I'm just going to sit here and, you know, connect in with the universal Rigpa or universal consciousness of the moment and just be peaceful and happy. And to me, that is, you know, like the ultimate spiritual bypass. But in a more common way, it can just be, yeah, I'm an asshole to my wife, but that's okay because everything's already perfect and pure. And she just doesn't understand that I'm beyond, you know, doing the dishes or whatever. So, you know, again, this can happen with any tradition. It's not just non-dualism, but it tends to show be much more pronounced there because it makes it easy to do things, to say things like, well, my emotions don't even matter. They're not mine at all. And my feelings don't matter. My thoughts don't matter. You know, people can check out in a pretty extreme way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. You know, I'll tell you, Ram Dass is funny. Sometimes he'll, like, I'm not sure if you know, but we do hold these retreats in Maui with Ram Dass, and Krishnas is a double bill thing. And there's always one of our, we have the only friends we have amongst the three of us and the other are Buddhists. We don't have any other friends. And that's just the way it is. And they're great friends. And so they're always out there at the retreat. And we have this wonderful combo, which it seems to be part of who we are, you know. And at the same time, Ram Dass will say, he'll talk about the exquisite nature, especially the, more around Buddhism in general, but more I think more around Tibetan Buddhism, where he's had, you know, known a lot of lamas and so on. The exquisite nature of the interpretation, shall we say, of reality. It seems to be the most well elucidated and thought out over these, you know, whatever, hundreds of years, 1,000 years, whatever. And he says that is such a trap for people to get caught in knowing in any way whatsoever, feeling like there's a knowing going on related to this cosmology that is just incredible. I even find myself at times I'll read something. My favorite teacher is one of them is Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. I'm sure you know who he is. And I'll get caught up in a way because of he's incredible. That the three or four lines can just give you such a feeling of grasping. No, I don't mean grasping that way. I mean of understanding or grokking something very deep and so on. And so, yeah, Ram Dass talks a lot about that trap, which is, to me, beyond the spiritual bypass.
Well, and, you know, the this isn't just Buddhism. They don't even use the word non-dualism in Buddhist scriptures. There's really only one that ever even uses the term. In Buddhism, it would be called emptiness. But the Advaita word, you know, non-dual Advaita is Advaita Vedanta, so it is Hindu, right? Yeah. And it's, of course, it's Hindu reformulation of Buddhist philosophy. It doesn't surprise me that you guys have all your Buddhist friends. I mean, Hinduism and Buddhism were buddies in India for a couple thousand years, right? You go to Ellora, right, there in Maharashtra, and you've got all those Buddhist and Hindu and Jain tantric caves all together. They were all practicing together.
Right. Well, let's talk. But there are a bunch of obvious intersecting things between the two of them. And in this blog that you wrote, you know, just that that the reality, there are not two things, but simply one. When we got to India, when in the first days with Neem Karoli Baba, he immediately went, sub ek, just one, only one. There's only one every day. There's only one. So, it's an obvious. Actually, in the old days when we were there, when you went through the gate of the ashram, written on top was, this is the non-dual Hanuman temple of wow. Neem Karoli Baba.
Wow. Which one was that? Which temple?
Kenchi.
Oh, Kenchi.
Yeah, I don't know if you made it.
I've been to the Neem Karoli Baba temple in Hardwar, and also I think there's
Rishikesh.
One in Vrindavan too.
Yeah,
Rishikesh. And I think Sri Ma was there. It was great. I had a nice time.
Oh, you actually had her darshan then, huh? Mm. Oh, lovely. Yeah, she just left us a couple of months ago.
Mm.
So that all one, and there is not two, there is one. And for us, we actually met somebody who was living in that state of not two, which it was a first for all of us, meeting somebody with that I that you could relate with, as you usually do with other people. it was a whole. Anyhow, just share with us, from this tradition and from what you teach and share with people, just share a little bit of what you feel would be really advantageous in terms of the deconstructing of the self-referential me on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, that is where things like typical Hindu tantric practice or the kind of deconstructive mindfulness that I'm working with a lot leads to a non-dual experience. So, the thing that you notice every day, if you pay attention, is that everything you're doing is being driven by thoughts and feelings, right? You've got emotions that are pulling you around. You're trying to have this good feeling and avoid that bad feeling. And that's a huge amount of your life is just trying to avoid a bad feeling or get a good feeling, right? That's almost like mechanical, pulling us back and forth. And then the same thing with thoughts. We want to, have pleasant thoughts. We want to avoid unpleasant thoughts. And then you mix those two things together, the thoughts and feelings. And if you look carefully, that's what most people call me. Right? That's our sense of self, is this kind of bundle of thoughts and feelings that's sort of trying to avoid certain things and trying to get other certain things. And, Raghu, it's really, whether it's strong meditation practice or maybe even a particular kind of psychedelic experience, which I have, no experience of, you can notice very clearly without even that much training, you can begin to notice, wow, those thoughts and feelings are just kind of there. They're just sort of happening. And it's not that we're trying to necessarily stop them or change them or anything, but just even noticing that that's not necessarily the deepest understanding of who you are, right? Mm-hmm. And even being able to just see, wow, I'm being bossed around by these feelings and by these thoughts. And yet that's not even me. Right, it's really that easy. Even if that realization takes a while to notice, it's right there. Right, it's right there, and just beyond that is the beginning of noticing that egoic sense of self arising and passing. It's constantly changing. It's moving. It's not an abiding, witness. It's not awareness. And so that already begins to move you into seeing that awareness or consciousness is what is actually abiding. It's what's really, if anything is really there, if we know anything is actually existing at all, it's conscious awareness, right? It's this being awareness. So to me, there's I always feel like there's thousands of techniques, and yet the thing they're trying to point out is really kind of simple, you know? And once you make that move into just vast spacious awareness or loving awareness, it definitely has a love component. What I think is really fascinating is some traditions make that atheistic and kind of like just rational, and that would be, let's say, more the Buddhist direction. But there's also, you know, completely rich, deep traditions of theistic non-dualism, which would be like Shankaracharya or something. Mm. You know, Hindu non-dualism is theistic. The one consciousness is God. So it almost leaves out the God or not God question, you know, it just goes straight to the awareness. So that's, I don't know, to me, it's so beautiful, and it's right there. Oh, is that your dog that I heard about in the podcast I was listening to?
Yeah. Well, at least they're not barking. Okay.
They're just coming up to me. Going to show them on the screen there?
No, I can't. Okay. I will after.
I was listening to your podcast with Tammy about the Dharma of Dogs, and I was like,
with Tammy. Oh, God, that was so great. I love that. I didn't even know she was that much of a dog person, so we had a great time.
Oh, my God, yeah. It doesn't get doggier than Tammy's world. Yeah.
That's it. Anyhow, I love what this referential point change really is what we're talking about. And Ram Dass, his thing is, you know, moving away from this thought, emotion, ego, role, referential me into heart center, whatever you want to call it, soul, spiritual heart. And just moving your perspective is, to me, is absolutely the first thing that everybody who goes, okay, I'm so fucked up, I need a change, or something happens, an enlightened moment, and you move in that direction. And certainly changing perspective is extraordinarily important, and that there is a way of using intention to do that, for sure. There's a few different things that I'd like to bring up that I just saw you either blogging about or on a podcast. One of them is you talk about accepting, and accepting, which is an important word, and changing how you're feeling. Because we all go through on a day-to-day basis, there's many shifts based on incoming phenomena that we eat up and move, and moves us into another place. Talk about that, because that's people certainly would, it would be very useful for people to be able to find a way to change that habitual pattern.
Well, you know, Raghu, there's this interesting tension in life and in the various spiritual traditions between accepting things just as they are and changing things or transforming things for the better. And I think it's easy for people to get stuck in one or the other of those directions. In fact, when I was describing spiritual bypassing, in a way, that's getting too stuck on leaving everything the way it is, right? It's all already perfect. I'm just going to accept it. And our society is really about doing things and changing things for the better. So we don't really like acceptance very much. And so we don't practice it very often. You know, you get over to Asian tradition in Asia, there's a lot more acceptance of just how difficult things can be. And we don't really do that so much.
And say very least.
Yeah. And so one of the first things for most people anyway, in Western culture is learning that surrender and acceptance and just letting some things be. There's some things that can't be. I mean, just it's so obvious, right? That I feel ridiculous having to say it. And yet I teach enough to know I have to say it, which is there's a lot of stuff that just can't be changed. The past can't be changed. You know, the weather can't be changed. The thing you did last week can't be changed. You know, and yet we are spending a tremendous amount of time all knotted up about that. And so for us in this kind of society, it's a big deal to learn acceptance and just to be able to be with what is. And yet, you know, once people feel the bliss of that and really settle into how wonderful that can be, that kind of giving up of all cares, you know, to Ram or whatever, it just unloading the burden, right? It's just such a joy. And so you can go too far the other way. And now that's when it's like, yeah, you still gotta clean the bathroom and do the dishes. Come on, we're not just gonna accept that the dishes are piling up. We're not gonna just accept that you know, you're being a jerk to your employees or, you know, whatever the person is doing. So there's this whole other pole to the dichotomy, right? To the interplay, which is remembering to improve. This is and change what can be changed and transform what can be transformed. I think it's just such a wonderful, beautiful paradox that in a way, you know, we are not our egos. Our egos are just happening compared to the perfection of awareness. They almost don't even matter. And yet at the same time, they are made of the perfection of awareness and creating, working to have a better ego just so people around you have a better time dealing with you is every yes. bit as holy as yes. connecting in with the beauty of awareness, yes. right? Yes. So this balance, and I think it's just so easy for me, that's for sure, let alone anybody else, but let's just say me, to get stuck on either just, oh, let's just accept, and then you get really passive and passive aggressive, and you know, or like, you know, when I was 25, it's like, I'm going to meditate till my head explodes because it's time to get enlightened. And, you know, you can just mm-hmm. get so involved in non-acceptance and change. And of mm-hmm. course, it's not even that it's the balance between those. It's like a yin yang where one is inside the other, right? Mm-hmm. Inside the change is this perfect acceptance. And inside the acceptance is this continuous change.
Well, it is the core thing here that we all do is not accept discomfort and not accept, and as you say, things that we cannot change, not accept and run rather than cozy up and make a little bit of friends with that discomfort or, you know, any kind of negative emotions and thoughts and so on that we all go through on a day-to-day basis. Let me just tell this little story because you just reminded me when you said, give it all up to Ram.
Yeah.
Right? Which is very much part of our tradition. So I see many people know this because I've been doing some podcasts because I was in India, although I was just there and just came back. I was also there towards the end of last year. And we were in... We went to a jungle in the middle of India in Madhya Pradesh to see our jungle Baba. We have somebody that we've met over the last few years through Neem Karoli Baba, and it's a very long, strange story, but he is a dreadlocked, looks like a Naga. You've been to India, right? The naked sadhus, but he's not naked anymore. And, you know, 25 years in and out of caves when he was 12, that kind of a thing. And he's totally Ram. It's just Ram. It's all Ram. So one time I said to him, and this is in relation, I hope it can help a little bit because it helped me in relation to running from discomfort or fear, whatever it may be. And I said, so you went out, you were a kid, and you went into a cave in the jungle and wild animals and no surety of getting food and no... You know, forget about comfort, you know. And I said, so what about fear? You mean to tell me? And he said, in the very beginning, there was fear. But just, you know, like very beginning, like when he was first there, days until, and folks out there, this doesn't just happen. This is somebody who's obviously done a million lifetimes of this kind of work to get to be a free being, which he seems to be. And he said, but then I realized the wild animals are Ram. the cold is Ram. The fear is Ram. It's all Ram. There's only, I realize there's only one thing going on. He didn't say it quite like that. Just yeah. Ram. There's only one thing going on. And once you feel that trust, and this is my words, you get a little bit, because that's what happened with me in the moment. I was sincere in asking about this. And then suddenly a little bit more of trust in that deepest part of ourselves that knows that, which is what you're talking about as far as I'm concerned when we talk about awareness and the pure, I mean, and that's why I love this blog, you know, it's so lovely. <It's>, non-dual awareness is so lovely. When I'll say Ram is so lovely, and I don't think there's any difference between the two.
Yeah, like I said, the theistic version of non-dualism is wonderful. I was talking to a friend of mine, Kelly Boys, who's a non-dual teacher who is also a Christian, and she was just talking about, you know, the field of awareness and being held by that in the form of Jesus. And I was like, wow, I just don't, that's not me. I don't go there, but I could feel it, you know.
Yeah, yeah, that's wonderful. Another thing that I think you do mention, and it's, I think there can be some incisive stuff for people here around mindfulness and emotions. And what you talked about was maintaining an emotional intelligence as part of mindfulness. And as you know, Danny Goleman, who wrote that great book, Emotional Intelligence, was part of our family over there back in the day. It's a great book. But just in terms of how you've integrated that concept within what you share with people.
Well, you just said the main point, which is cozying up to discomfort is really the essence of that idea. If there's something that we're doing in the version of mindfulness that I'm teaching and maybe a little bit of Shinzen's version, if there's something that we're doing too much of, it's cozy, like is accepting the discomfort. That's what we're into. So, you know, not in a masochistic way, but there's a ton of emotional discomfort you can't do anything about. It's just there. And the idea is, okay, let's sit with that. Let's be friends with it. Let's, you know, be curious about how it manifests in your body. Let's get into every little detail of those sensations. And as you do that, of course, you know, Raghu, that it starts to transform. It turns into something else, even if it's not that it becomes joy or whatever. The experience of even a very difficult emotion that you contact deeply with tremendous openness and clarity and acceptance is very different than an emotion that you're resisting and trying to run away from. And so integrating emotions into practice is, for me, that's the life changer. You know, as I work with students, when they can start to get it, it's a moment in practice, right? When they start to get it, like, oh, my whole life doesn't have to be about running away from a bad feeling. I can sit with that and it's actually not even that bad. And that suddenly something shifts where they can just begin to sink into a much, much deeper stillness and peacefulness, yeah, you know, and clarity. So that particular thing of you know, if I had anything to say ever to anybody out there, I would say, you know, you don't have to run from bad emotions. You can just sit with them and just see what they have to say and cozy up to them and let them transmit their wisdom to you. It's very, very deep teaching. And then, you know, my friend Rick Hansen will come in and say, no, you got to transform them into good emotions. And he's right, right? You could take it too far. So, you know, you don't want to just sit there with continuous depressed rumination either. You know, we can then begin to to transform those into something positive.
Yeah. In my own experience, I found that the sitting there, just to take that in a little bit more detail, the sitting there with whatever that negative thing is, or fear, you're sitting there, I think the obviousness of going through the sensations in your body, that's why Vipassana practice is excellent practice. I highly recommend that.
I wish everyone from every other practice had just a little bit more of Vipassana skill. It helps everything.
Yeah, it helps everything. You know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, I heard years ago, would have his novice monks do Vipassana.
You bet. Yeah. Any tantric tradition, right? You start out in Vipassana, and then, or at least tantric Buddhism, you start out in Vipassana, then go Mahayana, and eventually end up in tantric practices.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But if so, once you're sitting, there's, I suggest a way of like internal embracing. You're actually taking your arms and inside yourself. It can be physically, but actually embracing, the feeling of embracing that is human. We are human. It's okay. And just feeling, eventually you can actually go into that Ram Dass's loving awareness heart space where you're actually, you're loving what it is that you're feeling. And to me, that's the same as this Baba going on about, it's Ram, every aspect. Whatever phenomena is coming into you in that moment is Ram. You are Ram. There is only one pool of, and once you get there, the sting will go away. Of that,
the second arrow is removed. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, Raghu, one time a couple of years ago, I was in Zurich, and if you've never been to Zurich, it's a wonderful place in Switzerland, and there's a large cathedral there that I think, I'm not mistaken, it was built by the Protestants. So it's a huge Protestant cathedral. It's like in the city square, and it's gorgeous. And so I was checking it out, and there weren't a ton of tourists. It was big and beautiful, and I walked up to the top and so on. But outside in the square, which was very tiny, the square around this enormous cathedral is remarkably small. And in that square was a brass model of the cathedral, like maybe a meter long or something, and a meter high. And I was like, that is the strangest thing. Like, what is that? Like, here's the cathedral, and over there is a brass model of the cathedral. It didn't make any sense. But I noticed, like, it was covered with a patina, but then, like, in certain areas, the patina was worn away. And that started dawning on me what it must be. And sure enough, when I got over there, it had Braille on the front of it. So the idea was, you're going to, like, if you were blind, you could still, quote, you know, see the cathedral by touching this brass model with your hands. So devotional people who happened to be non-sighted could come in and feel the cathedral, right? It was really, really just beautiful. But to me, that's Vipassana of emotions. You are yes, hugging them, and yes, loving them. And even more, you're trying to do that thing of almost like, if you imagine that blind person touching that model, getting into every little tiny nook and cranny and detail and feeling it with both hands, so that you're getting this really high resolution, really subtle, curious, almost like aesthetic appreciation for the feel of the emotion.
Visceral.
Visceral, but also like tactile, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? You feel it with your body. I always say to people, you know, you want to feel the feeling of the feeling. And that's where it starts to move into curiosity and into a different kind of openness, where it's not just like, you know, for some people, embracing a difficult emotion is like hugging their like stinky uncle or something. It's like, they're going to do it. But it's kind of, they're kind of like not enjoying it at all. It's just like, yeah, I'm hugging it, while they're all, you know, tensed up against it. And you want to have this, this different kind of thing where it's almost like you're listening to a symphony, or, you know, exploring a painting with your eyes, or, you know, it's an aesthetic, detailed, embodied, visceral experience of the arising of that emotion in the flesh.
Mm. Yeah. I'm sticking with, you got to end up hugging your stinky uncle, okay? Forget about it.
I probably am the stinky uncle.
hey, so great to meet you, Michael, on the air here. Having a good time. Oh, and Michael has some wonderful books, Mindful Geek. Do you know about Buddhist geeks? They're my friends in Nashville here.
Yeah, me and Vince.
Vince.
Yeah.
Oh, great. And a non-dualism, a what history of a timeless concept?
Brief. A bunch of time jokes in there. Yeah.
Yeah, really. And something on ego, right?
I wrote together with Peter Bauman, the original member of Tangerine Dream.
We
collaborated on a book about ego.
Oh, some time back?
This is about 10 years ago.
Uh-huh. Wow. Okay. So all of that will be on the show notes of the Mind Rolling podcast page with Michael and links to Dion Yogi, right? We're going to put that.
Yeah, dyc.org is that link.
Yeah. Okay. And so our people that put that together are going to have all those links and links to your books. Because you have a very light and delightful way of deconstructing.
Thanks, Raghu. Well, it's such a pleasure to meet you and to talk with you.
Well, we do have to thank somebody, though, Michael.
Who are we thanking?
Dr. Brian Lewis.
Ah, okay. Yeah, he was down there in Asheville. That's where I met him.
Yeah, well, he's the one who said, you got to talk to Michael Taft on Mind Rolling. Are you kidding? He's become a friend. And he's a great doctor.
We had a little meeting of sort of outcast Buddhist practitioners down there at Asheville. And that's, he was.
Oh, really?
He was in there. It was great. We had a wonderful time.
Oh, that's wonderful. So everybody, like I said, you'll get all the links to be able to get a little to cozy up to Uncle Michael.
Sticky Uncle Michael, yeah.
and share, and because the practical quality of a good mindfulness teacher for everyone is inestimable, as far as I'm concerned, because it provides a very, very clear path to dealing with this stuff that we all deal with on a day-to-day. So I thank you for that, Michael.
So true, as long as we can find one. Yeah, thanks, Roger.
All right, everybody, we'll see you next week on Mind Rolling, and we'll do this again, Michael.
That'd be great.